City is facing an affordable housing crisis, with more and more New Yorkers each year trying to survive without the most basic necessities of a stable home. But this crisis is also a paradox, because on the books, New York City has some of the strongest tenant protections in the country and the largest system of rent-controlled apartments, about $1 billion. So why isn't it working? A team of New York Times reporters investigated this for months and found out that the systems put in place to protect tenants are overwhelmed and broken. Their investigative series is called Unsheltered, and it tells the heartbreaking stories of tenants who find themselves one legal fight or paycheck away from losing their homes, even when the law is on their side. With us to discuss the series are Kim Barker, a reporter at the New York Times Metro Desk, and Sunny Kleinfeld, who recently retired from the Metro Desk after 40 years. Kim, Sunny, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So, Kim, I will start with you. Can you give us an overview of affordable housing here? There's rent stabilized, and there's, I think, some traces of rent controlled still left. What's the difference?
Well, the difference between rent-controlled and rent-stabilized housing is that rent-controlled housing has been phased out since the 70s, and it's for older buildings usually built before 1947, and the tenants will have lived there since 1974, right? And if a rent-controlled apartment comes out of rent control, if the tenant, say, dies, or if, like, all the decedents die or move on, then it becomes rent stabilized. And those apartments are very, very cheap. These are sort of the mythical apartments that everybody hears about in New York.
Like $50, 3,000 square feet.
You know, Monica lived in one in Friends. It was like, you know, $300 for this huge loft. Those don't really exist anymore. And when you do have these rent-controlled apartments, and the latest housing survey said that there are something like 20,000 rent-controlled apartments left in the city, they're often decrepit. They've been left there to just basically fester. You've got plaster walls, you know, and mold growing on them. They haven't been painted in years. The floors are coming up. And that's what's happened to a lot of the rent-controlled stock in the city.
And how long has New York City had this system of these two, rent stabilization and rent control?
Well, it's been basically since 1974. But like, if you go back, there's been some attempt at rent regulation in New York since the early 1920s. So we're talking about almost a century of this. And the whole reason was to try to combat the idea of a housing emergency in New York. And a housing emergency is defined if there's a vacancy rate like less than 5%. New York is always in a housing emergency. And I think that you find that's why everybody's always talking about rents in a way in New York that you never have elsewhere. Like, what do you pay? You know, when did you move in? Is it stabilized or not? And how many roommates do you have? How many people are living in that 800 square foot apartment?
It is the most common conversation to overhear.
I know.
On any
it's so
street.
Boring, but yet so important.
It is. It's central. It's that central organizing principle. Sunny, when did we start to see the system of rent-regulated housing deteriorate?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess it began almost, you know, from the 70s on. I mean, even, you know, it just grew and grew and grew.
But from its inception.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you start with these laws to protect tenants. And then it slowly eradicates. You get landlords find ways to work around them. There's loopholes. You know, a big part of the problem is that it's so easy to file cases against tenants. It's so easy to harass tenants. You know, a constant problem in housing is just landlords not keeping the apartments up, and which was really the impetus for starting housing court initially. And so what you have is you know, it's so easy for a landlord to file an eviction case. It's so hard, easy for them to lie about whether somebody is in arrears on their rent. There are cases that are brought, and it's been an increasingly aggressive tactic by landlords to file cases for reasons other than rent arrears. And that's a very, you know, murky, subjective area, which can cover almost anything that's considered objectionable. I mean, somebody, I can say somebody's unruly, they're, you know, bothering other tenants, they're smoking marijuana, they're destroying the apartment themselves and things like that. And the problem is that people, tenants, don't know the system, and landlords know the system very
right.
well. And landlords are represented by lawyers almost entirely, and very few tenants are. So you have a very unbalanced system.
And for those who have had the good fortune of not experiencing a housing court, describe the scene for us, because it's very particular in terms of once that elevator opens and you step into the hallway, the atmosphere is quite distinct.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote specifically about Brooklyn Housing Court.
Right. Where a lot of the action is these days.
Yeah. I mean, it's the second busiest, but it's the borough where gentrification and the drive by landlords to get apartments out of regulation is so strong. And what you have there is you have a building that was a commercial building. It was not built as a courthouse. It has been used as Brooklyn Housing Court. And everything about it is unsuitable for a court. The courtrooms don't look like courtrooms. They're too small. Everybody rides the same elevator. In a normal courthouse, you have, you know, court employees or especially judges who have their own private elevators to use. Here you have judges going up and down elevators, mixing in with tenants who they just evicted or are considering evicted. And you have them waiting until they get off. You've had, you know, one judge told me about being tailed to the ATM after court
right.
day. And you have terrible, grimy conditions, filthy bathrooms. And most of the action in housing court doesn't happen in the courtroom. Very few cases go to trial because the system's inadequate as it is to deal with cases being settled, but it's certainly inadequate to ever have very many trials. And so the whole impetus is to have settlements between landlords and tenants. And what you have is you have people come and they sit and they wait for hours in a courtroom, and then you have a lawyer from the landlord come in and call their name. And they go out and summon them out to the hallways, which is where all the settlement talk takes place. And the hallways are packed with people. There's no privacy. There's insufficient seating. So what you have is a tenant being confronted by a landlord lawyer, totally baffled by what the system is and what their rights are, and if they even understand their rights, how they can implement their rights. And they're in rapid-fire fashion, they're offered, you know, settlement terms. And they don't know if they're good settlement terms. They don't know if they have other options or whatnot. They've often taken a day off from work and need to get back, or they have kids to pick up from school. And so they're pressured and they're, you know, emotional about the whole situation since their housing is at stake. And so they often agree to terms that, you know, are the worst possible terms for them. And then they wait and they're brought up before a judge who doesn't understand the case. And in a matter of a minute or minutes, they say, do you understand this stipulation? And they say yes, because they don't know anything else to say, and they agree to things. And,
yeah. And judges going through 70, 80, as much as 90 cases in a day, I think you said one of the judges had. Kim, is rent-stabilized housing ever a good deal for landlords, or does it keep their income artificially low?
Well, the whole reason that we have rent stabilization is because that was the policy of the government. So it's not like a landlord is coming in and buying a place and all of a sudden, oh my God, this is rent stabilized. I had no idea. If they did their due diligence, they would know that it did have rent stabilized apartments and what the rate, what their, you know, return was going to be. There are different, and this is so complicated, there are different kinds of rent stabilization, right? I think most people in New York are familiar with the idea of the more traditional kind of stabilization. And these are the buildings that were built before 1974 with like six or more units. And these buildings can be pushed in, these apartments can be pushed into the free market. There's a threshold that's now about $2,733.75. And that is the threshold above which they want to push the rents, right? And then they go into the free market. The other kinds of stabilized apartments are stabilized through tax break programs, and they can be stabilized at very, very high rates of rent. So this isn't necessarily affordable. And that's part of what we wanted to get at the series, is the whole idea that just because, you know, you've got stabilized housing, it doesn't mean that it's affordable for, you know, folks. You can get rent stabilized at like $6,000 a month. But at least you know that what your rent is going to go up every year. And I've, you know, I've heard the argument a lot about the idea that like landlords, they don't make a lot of money off of rent stabilized apartments, but they knew they were rent stabilized. And the whole idea, and what we tried to write about, is the idea that that's made these buildings attractive. That like this is part of like, you know, the advertising for these buildings. Lots of upside potential, lots of value to be unlocked. And it seems very cynical. I mean, the only way you can do that is to push people out.
Right. And I want to underscore, because, you know, so much of the rhetoric in the city since de Blasio took office has been about more affordable housing. So the idea of creating new affordable housing. But really what you guys focus in on is the quote unquote affordable housing that's already there, the rent stabilized apartments. Those are what are going. So we're not even talking about adding more housing. We're talking about what's already in place and that stuff disappearing.
Right.
And you mentioned this threshold, this $2,700 threshold, that once the rent gets to that point, then it becomes market rate. Talk to us about the tools and mechanisms landlords and developers have to get their rents up to that threshold.
And again, this is super complicated, but let's just take a building that's got, let's say, 10 stabilized apartments in it. And somebody comes in and they're determined to unlock that value. What will often happen next is they will send somebody throughout the building and they'll say, look, you've been here how many years? Do you really like this place? It's kind of crummy. How about I give you $10,000 to leave, right? How about I give you $20,000 to leave? Here's a stack of cash. I will give this to you right now if you leave. And they'll get some people out that way, right? And the person who was always thinking about going back home and like is happy to take the money and run. And this isn't...
People who've never seen lump sums of money, $10,000 sounds like a lot of money.
It sounds like a great deal of money. And we talked to plenty of folks who would take that money and think, oh, now I'll be able to get the apartment of my dreams. And they go through that money quite quickly. So in this building, this theoretical building, you get some people who leave because of they agree to take the buyout, right? And then in those apartments, right away, construction will start. And the whole idea is like you automatically, as a landlord, get to add 20%, somewhere around 20% on top of the rent when you get a new tenant in. So vacancy bonus, vacancy bump, vacancy increase. It's called a bunch of different things. It amounts to 20%, which is a huge jump as it is, right? So automatically, you're allowed to do that. You add 20% to the rent that it was. And then you do construction and you do renovations and, you know, or you don't and you say you did, or you do the bare minimum and you say it costs much more, right? At that point, you can then increase the rent even more for those renovations. They're called individual apartment improvements. And at this point, all you have to do is tell the state, I got a new tenant, or this tenant is gone, I've got a new tenant, and I've increased the amount of rent X amount because I did this much in renovations. You do not have to do anything like, here are my receipts. You do not have to submit proof. You don't have to do anything like that. And then a new tenant moves in, and they have no idea what's happened. They have no idea what happened before. Oftentimes, like, the whole goal in a lot of these places is to carve the apartments up into ever smaller rooms, right? So maybe you're near NYU, maybe you're near Columbia, you know, get the college kids in there who have no idea about rent stabilization or anything like that, and their parents are paying the bills anyway, and it seems like a good enough deal, and they'll leave in a year again anyway, and then you can do the same thing again with that apartment. Meanwhile, you've got the rest of the apartments, right? And they're, you know, being harassed by the construction oftentimes. And then you'll have housing court cases come in, and the whole idea of trying to push ever more people out and then putting them through the renovation mill and just and eventually jacking as many apartments out of regulation as possible.
And it seems like the important point here is this breakdown between this robust set of laws that we have in place and enforcement. And
yes,
you've sort of hinted at that with sort of the self-reporting on renovations and self-reporting on rent histories and this kind of stuff.
And
right?
Self-reporting on, you know, building permit applications, you know, allowing architects and engineers to certify this is what we're doing and we're only doing this. And, you know, this is how tenants will be protected or won't be protected, and all these cookie cutter tenant protection plans that we wrote about in the series. And there's not a lot of communication between the different agencies that are supposed to regulate this. You don't have, it was only in December of 2016 that you had the state agency that oversees regulated housing agree to share which apartments and which buildings had regulated apartments with the city department of buildings. So they even had some sort of sense of like which apartments they should look for this happening more. Only in December of 2016. It's very recently.
Right. I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Kim Barker of the New York Times and Sonny Kleinfeld about their series Unsheltered. Sonny, you actually spoke to tenants who had been promised buyouts that were never delivered or delivered in smaller amounts, yes?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most egregious was somebody who came into housing court being evicted for non-payment. It was a sketchy case that he even was in arrears, but he was promised $50,000 to leave, which, you know, again, as Kim was saying, it seems like a phenomenal amount of money, but it's not a phenomenal amount of money in New York. But people agree to these things. And so he agreed to that and moved out. And then...
And for our listeners, arrears, explain for us what rent...
Behind on the rent, yeah. You know, and I mean, ordinarily, you would expect somebody to be given some sort of grace period and you know, if they're 1 month behind on the rent, you know, you'd give them a period and 2-3 months behind your rent before somebody might file a case. You've got cases where 1 month, you know, the day after 1 month, cases are being filed. And, you know, you also have cases where people are not behind on their rents and cases are filed. In any event, he agreed to this amount of money. He was given a check. He had moved out by the time he got the check. He deposited the check, and the check didn't clear. It was stopped by the landlord. He complained about it. He had no leverage, really, at that point on his own. And so, you know, the landlord basically told him, you know, tough, that's the way it goes. And he handed him another check, which did clear, which was for $2,500. But all the time, you know, you'd see in housing court negotiations over getting buyouts. And the problem is that, you know, as Kim was saying, that people don't realize how little this amount of money gets them. They've never seen anything like it. They don't really know how to manage it. But they're giving up something far more valuable than what they're being paid for. And unfortunately, even some of the tenants who are represented by lawyers, and, you know, and the vast majority are not, are going along with some of these buyouts to get cases done.
Well, a lot of times, too, the buyouts come accompanied by some of these other tools and mechanisms that you've highlighted, making unsafe living conditions or making it difficult to live in a construction zone, essentially. Some landlords even doing damage to their own buildings or turning off heat. Like, these sort of mechanisms are used in conjunction with buyouts to provoke people to accept them, yes?
No, absolutely. I mean, there was, you know, one case that I followed for a while. It had been going on for years, and it was multiple cases against multiple people in this building. It was a building actually the landlord lived as well. They were routinely not provided with heat, and, you know, and the tenants would complain. This one woman complained, and the landlord told her, you know, there's a place down the block where you can buy blankets for $20, you know. And then she complained, well, you know, what if I have friends over, you know. So they hand out blankets and said, we don't have friends over in the winter time, you know.
Remarkable. Discomfort for some and serious health issues for others. You think of the elderly living alone and small children. I'm speaking with New York Times reporter Kim Barker and journalist Sonny Kleinfeld about their new series, Unsheltered. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. I'm speaking with Kim Barker of the New York Times and Sonny Kleinfeld, formerly of the New York Times, after 40 years of good work. So let's talk a little bit more about housing court. I'm curious to know, Sonny, about how, percentage-wise, how many tenants bring cases against landlords versus landlords bringing tenants to court?
Well, that's virtually,
or is there a huge asymmetry there? I mean,
well, there's no symmetry at all. I mean, yeah. It's virtually all, you know, landlords bringing cases against tenants. I mean, the odd thing is housing court was started in 1973. Before that, the housing cases were just mixed in with other cases in the other court. And the original purpose really was to make sure that apartments were kept in good repair. So the original purpose was really that a forum for tenants to make sure that if they had broken appliances, you know, no heat, things like that, cracked plaster and so forth, that they would be protected by the housing court. That remains a function of housing court, but it remains a very small function of housing court. And there's only one courtroom really where tenants bring cases against landlords these days. And the court is almost, I mean, it's deficient in almost all of its functions, but it's particularly deficient in making sure that repairs are ever done to apartments. And so much of the system is, in New York, is really a reactive system. If you complain, then, you know, things are looked into. And all the time, even in the eviction cases, they're always asked by the judges, are there any repairs that need to be done? And they're included in these stipulation agreements that are made. But there's no enforcement procedure for these. And the judge will always tell them, you know, if these repairs aren't done by this date when you're supposed to pay your arrears, you know, come back and tell me. You know, first of all, come back and tell me is not an easy thing for somebody right. to do when they're working or have other responsibilities in life. But they come back and tell him, and so he issues another order that these repairs are to be done by this date, 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later, and it goes on and on and on. And what happens is eventually people give up on it, and they live with what they have, or they do sometimes repairs themselves, and then they will withhold rent to offset the cost of the repairs, which is perfectly legal and they're right, and then they get eviction right. cases brought against them for yeah. being in arrears.
Now, and this point about coming back is well taken, because you guys do a good job of showing how it can become a part-time job trying to stay in your apartment, and even the line outside of housing court signifies that. Kim, how would a tenant know if they were moving into an apartment that had been previously rent stabilized? Again, this goes back to sort of the responsibility being on the tenant, yes?
Well, yeah, they should know. They should be told at this point what the last rent was and how they got to the rent that they're at now, if it's coming out of stabilization. And they should, if they're still stabilized, they should be given a lease that says it's stabilized and be told what the last rent was before. It's just a question of enforcing whether that's actually happening. And I think it's also a matter of education, like the whole idea of people coming in new to these apartments and new to the city, understanding what their rights as tenants are and understanding what exactly stabilization is. I had no idea. My first apartment that I went to that had stabilization in it, I had no idea what that actually meant. I thought, okay, fine, it means it's stable. Maybe the rent won't go up as high. But I had no idea what that meant about the history of the apartment or how the rent had indeed gotten to where it was already. So there have been, you know, patchwork fixes that are done. But again, it always is on the tenant to actually know their rights, investigate them, ask for their rental history, make sure that, like, the, you know, improvements that are being claimed have actually been done, and to see if there's any unexplained jumps in those rent histories.
Kim, it seems that the problem with bringing a landlord to court is that
there's many problems.
Yes. But one of them is fines are just a slap on the wrist, right?
Compared
to how much money they stand to make once they convert a rent-stabilized apartment into a high-end rental. 632 Sterling Place, which you cover in great detail in this series, is a good example. Can you tell us a little bit about that building?
Well, we just happened, we pulled a lot of housing court records for the project, and myself and a colleague were looking at all court cases filed with a particular law firm for a couple months last year. And in the middle of one of those court cases was 20 years of rental history for every single apartment in the building. It's inexplicable as to why it was in this court file. It involved a superintendent. But for the first time, you were able to see, like, how these different apartments were jumping in rent and how they were moving into the free market, which is unusual. You never get to see that. It's not considered public record. You'd have to get every single tenant in a building to go request their rental history, which is very difficult to do because people are suspicious of reporters showing up at their front doors. Think about it. You know, if I show up and say, hey, could you request your rental history? Really, I'm here to help. I don't know that people would necessarily believe me.
Right.
So we had this base data, and then we actually went through and tried to talk to every single person who lived in an apartment that had gone into the free market to see how much money was being charged as opposed to the other apartments. And this was just simply an average building. This was not a building that was particularly bad, particularly good. It was simply a building we had data for. I thought it was really interesting to see how quickly the rents would move up once it went into the free market. And you're talking about, like, these big apartments. So they were very easily able to get, like, you know, $3,900 a month, even $4,400 a month at this building.
And something that really stood out to me in the reporting is, you know, it you would think that this is some kind of underground network in terms of how to capitalize buildings in this way. But you talk about how this is flaunted in advertisements for buildings that go onto the market. In the actual text for the advertisement, it talks about how there's capacity to increase the capitalization of the building. And banks are complicit in this, right?
Yes.
We see funding that is tied to a building's potential earnings, no?
Right. Yeah, banks will issue mortgages not based on what a rent roll actually it is, but what the aspirations are for that rent roll and how much this apartment could get on the free market. And so that, by its very nature, indicates that banks are saying, okay, well, you know, they'll be able to get this at some point, which to me does, you know, indicate a level of complicity in what's been happening. And especially that was happening a lot in, you know, say 2007, 2006, before what, you know, the crash in 2008.
And then going back to 632 Sterling Place, Miss Wilkie was one of the tenants there. Tell us her story and what happened to her.
Oh, yes. Miss Cynthia Wilkie at 632 Sterling Place. She basically was this woman who's now 62 years old, and she's had a double bypass, and she's caring for her daughter who had, got cancer when she was like 6 years old and in a wheelchair, blind. And she's also caring for her brother who had lost a leg to diabetes and two grandchildren who were living with them. And they had lived in this apartment since 1993. And the new owner bought the place and said he would buy the place in late 2014. And then immediately came in and trying to push out the tenants who remained. And there were tenants still in four stabilized apartments in the building. And so he basically started off by offering cash buyouts, $20,000, $40,000, putting piles of cash in front of her on the table and the other tenants there. And two of the tenants did agree to go, one of whom had dementia, and we could never find her or her family. We were told that, like, she did not get the buyout, but it's impossible for us to prove that one way or the other. The other woman said that she never got the money that was promised to her. So then this landlord told the Department of Buildings he wanted to do this massive renovation, turn it from 7 units into 10 units, and submitted a very minor tenant protection plan that basically said the tenants will be protected. At the same time, he also told the Department of Buildings that the building was vacant and had no, you know, rent stabilized or rent controlled units in it. So all this sort of contradictory stuff. The permit is eventually approved, and then the tenants most definitely were not protected. They started taking down the building around Miss Wilkie and her neighbor and her family. And, you know, you had parts of the ceiling that were taken off. You had, like, water coming in from the rain. You had a staircase that was removed. You had a level of dust such that Wendy Wilkie, Cynthia's daughter, who was in the wheelchair, said she was having seizures and having trouble breathing because of it. There was no heat. No hot water. They had to buy space heaters pile blankets on Wendy during the winter months. And they didn't know where to turn, right? You know, a lot of times I think tenants in these situations, they don't want to complain necessarily against their landlord because their landlord is their landlord. And that is the one person that determines whether they have a place to live.
Right.
And this was their home, right? So I feel like, you know, they waited a few months before complaining. Do we call 311? What do we do, right? And so eventually, you know, they called 311. Eventually, the buildings department got out there and eventually went out there with a task force and gave all sorts of fines, ordered that the building be vacated in August of that year. And then Ms. Wilkie had to go into a shelter, what's effectively a shelter. They're using these hotels like Days Inn and Sleep Inns as shelters throughout the city. And so her and her family had to go into Days Inn in Queens, a borough they had never lived in before. You know, the high school student, her grandson, had to do this incredible commute to try to get to his school in Brooklyn, where he was graduating from high school. And, it's like they didn't have a kitchen. They didn't have a place to store their food. They were cramped into, like, two rooms, basically. You had five adults that were supposed to be living in two rooms, you know, Wendy and her mother, Cynthia, and, you know, also the granddaughter were staying in one room, two on one bed, one on the other. And in the other room was Cynthia's brother and grandson. And it was just like, it was so crowded that you couldn't even really get Wendy's wheelchair through it.
And their whole lives disrupted. And we know from so many well-documented cases that once a landlord gets you out of your apartment, it's very hard to get back in, even if you're living at a Days Inn. You know, we have some landlords calling, as you might imagine, telling us that we're not all scumbags.
They're not.
But here's one thing that you focus in on. You know, a lot of smaller landlords who might own one or two buildings are getting squeezed out by these bigger conglomerates or playing a bigger role in the sort of real estate scene. Sonny, one landlord told you that at the end of the day, the landlord is not a social safety net. Was this a common frustration among landlords?
The landlords complain about housing court just as much as tenants complain about housing court, even though it's been a very effective tool for them. And they complain, often in the context of how the rest of the country works. I mean, it takes, you know, it does take weeks, it takes months to get people out of apartments, and they think that's unreasonable, and much of the rest of the country you can get people out in a couple of days. You don't even have to go through the court system at all. And so they complain that everything is tilted towards tenants. But on the other hand, you know, as some judges will acknowledge too, landlords come into the system knowing this is a system, or they ought to know the system, particularly if they're large landlords. And, you know, as Kim was pointing out, large landlords come in and buy these buildings with the expectation of, you know, eliminating tenants and driving up rents. And they know full well what it takes to get people out in the amount of time, and they know all the various measures and ways of harassing them. They use that. On the other hand, you know, small landlords play by the same rules as everybody else, and there are a lot of small landlords where if they miss collecting rent for a month, they have trouble making the mortgage on their small building.
Right, and then they're put in a position where their most viable absolutely. Option is to sell to a big conglomerate and take the value of the building. And there's also risk for fighting back, right? I mean, there are ideas of a tenant blacklist that circulate, yeah. right? And so that's a fear for tenants.
Yeah, it is. If you're taken to housing court, and if you have a less than common name, you go on something that's known informally as the tenant blacklist. And it makes perfect sense. When you're a landlord and you're looking to rent to somebody new, you want to see what their record is. Have they ever been brought to court before? What was there a judgment against this person? And so even if you're sued and you don't know it, or you're sued and it wasn't your fault, and or you're sued because you were withholding rent because the repairs weren't done, you go onto this tenant blacklist, and it can make it very difficult for you to get an apartment in the future. And they've tried to fix this, right? They've said that, okay, no longer can housing courts sell this material to companies that do the blacklist, but the courts now basically allow contractors for LexisNexis to sit inside these courtrooms, well, not the courtrooms, but the clerk's offices where you get court right. records all day long and type in cases. So, you know, in a way, they're enabling this tenant blacklist.
The important thing to underscore, I think, for people out there is that there is a right to counsel, right? And this is one of the ways that de Blasio administration, I think, has been successful in terms of more funding for legal services. But I think it's important for tenants to realize they have that right.
They do. And it's being rolled out, though. So it's not going to be everywhere for another 5 years. And again, it's only for folks who are low income. And it remains to be seen how it's going to work, because the courts are already so overloaded. I mean, I know Sonny saw this, and it's going to be interesting to see if they add enough judges, if they add any judges, if they add any capacity to be able to handle more cases and more representation, because right now the system is... feels like it's held together, you know, a little bit right. with rubber bands,
Very
right?
quickly, do you have a suggestion for tenants in rent-regulated housing for more information where they could go?
I mean, they should read our stories. We have a guide as to what to do. And then also, you know, request your rental history. It's just interesting for no other reason than to see how rents have increased in the city.
I second that. Read the series. It is a fantastic series. Great reporting. Thank you both for doing it. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with New York Times reporter Kim Barker and journalist Sonny Kleinfeld about their new series, Unsheltered.